When I was in flight training, every so often, there was a particular flight we had to do. In fact, there was only three of them that were scheduled, and they
called OCF flights, meaning out of control flights. And the purpose was, you went up with an instructor, and he made the airplane depart controlled flight, but he did it in a very violent manner. And in particular, this is the flight that you would take where you were upside down spinning around and around in a very high G maneuver with the expectation that with training, you would get the airplane back under control, ride it, and then, you know, go off and it'd be no big deal. And they typically did this before you went on a particular type of a solo flight where you might encounter this kind of a thing. And OCF flights, they make for great stories. They are not fun at all. It is not comfortable being upside down, hanging in your straps with all the blood being pushed into your head, and you could just feel the veins, you know, throbbing in your head. Some guys would come back and it would even do some stuff to their eyeballs, you know, rupture some of the things in their eyeballs. And so you came back, it didn't look pretty, it didn't feel pretty, and it wasn't enjoyable. Well, I tell you all that because in some ways it reminds me a little bit of today's passage. How's that for an intro and to get you ready? This passage, though, is designed to do something. It's designed to show you that sometimes God lets you get off your equilibrium. And God is giving you this training, giving me this training in order to help us sort of get our equilibrium as things get wildly out of control. And yet at the same time, sometimes God is letting it continue. He's meaning to show you something. As we've been going through this book, and as we went through chapters 3 and chapters 4, some of you might recall that the preacher, in talking to us about meaning in life, listed a number of different things that he says is all part of God's timing. And some of these things we say, yes, that's great. But there are other things where we question, wait a minute, I don't know. How can that actually be part of God's plan? Things like oppression. How does that all fit into the plan of God? And as a result, the preacher realizes something that we all struggle with. There are times we struggle with God's omnipotence, meaning he's over everything. He's all powerful. So why, if he's all powerful, do these hard and difficult things happen to us? And when we struggle with this, our emotions rise high, don't they? We do. That's how we respond. It's a very emotional response often. And we have in the scriptures many psalms, some of them we call them the lament psalms, that show us the ways that God shows us that we can express that emotion. You heard it here. Emotion is not a bad thing. It's not. Unbridled emotion that drives you, that is not where we're called to go. And so God helps us with our emotions and how we respond to him. And one of the things that we learn in the Word is we can actually question God. We can ask him the difficult questions. But can we challenge God? That might be a different matter there. And the preacher in this text is giving us somewhat of a reminder. And that is, he's saying, look, you may come to God, you may have questions. Don't be careless in how you approach God. Remember who he is and who you're dealing with. In particular, when you have a propensity to want to be impulsive in how you respond to him, and maybe even how you would challenge him as opposed to question him. Feelings can make us sometimes almost flippant with God. And so even if we're frustrated, one of the things this text is going to help us see is there, he is holy and he is righteous, and we must respond to that. Even if we have our feelings, if our emotions, even if we have our struggles, we've got to remember that about him. So at the end of this book, you know, one of the keys that is said about finding meaning in life, I'll go ahead and give you the spoiler because we haven't explored it in depth. One of them, he says, is to fear God. And here what we're going to have is a break from examining meaning. And we're going to see a little bit about what fear of God looks like. Because I could say fear God, and what does that mean? Well, here's a nuance, a shade of what fearing God looks like. And I'm going to give you the big idea of where we're going so that you understand that. And you can kind of bring the text back and compare it to this. But ultimately, it said a healthy fear of God won't treat him in a rash and impulsive manner. That's where this text is going to take us. A healthy fear of God won't treat him in a rash or an impulsive manner. So let's see how it works out in the text that Jeff just read. First, the preacher is going to address coming to God with what we'll call hasty words. All right? Verse 1. Guard your steps as you go to the house of God and draw near to listen rather than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know they are doing evil. When I went to England, you can ride on the metro, their version of the metro, the rail system out there, and I don't even know what it's called. But I do remember they had all these signs out next to it. It says, Mind the Gap. Laura, you seen Mind the Gap on all the walls? And it's their version of basically saying, watch your step. So there's a space that is between the train and where you disembark from the train and to step on the concrete or the ground. There's a little gap. So they're saying, mind the gap. Be careful when you make this transition. Here, it's as if the preacher is telling us, mind the gap between God's holiness and the flippancy of your speech. There's a carefulness that you want to have. And if you're going through, and if you're not, you will go through some of the things that we saw listed in the previous chapter here in the book of Ecclesiastes. Things like injustice, oppression, being forgotten. The preacher is reminding us, you can certainly talk to God, absolutely, but think about it before you just impulsively rant and start throwing your demands. In other words, mind the gap when you're coming to Him. And you go into the book of Job. God says that Job went through these sufferings and he did not necessarily do something to invite those sufferings. But Job doesn't know that. He's just going through it. And so as he's struggling with this, he's questioning God all throughout the book. And Job comes very close to crossing the line on a number of different occasions because he didn't understand. And that emotion, that feeling of what I'm going through versus who God is, and couldn't he stop this? He's starting to struggle with this, and he's questioning God certainly. But he ultimately had to come around to realizing something. When God gave him questions about who are you, what have you created in the planet, you know, that goes on, that's timeless beyond you, and, you know, who are you to control the animals? You're nobody, Job. And Job came to a realization, you're right. I don't really understand like God does. In fact, Job made this statement. He says, I have declared that which I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. In other words, I thought I would lecture God, but now I realize I got nothing to say. I just need to cover my mouth and trust Him. Verse 2, he goes on. He says, do not be hasty in word or impulsive in thought to bring up a matter in the presence of God. For God is in heaven and, look at this, you are on the earth. Therefore, let your words be few. We are on the earth. That's a statement that's supposed to remind us that there is a humility of remembering the gap of who we are and who God is, and our limited view and understanding of things. You know, back in World War I, it wasn't used often, but sometimes men in the trenches would be fighting their enemy, and somebody could take a hot air balloon, and they could go up, and they could see things that the enemy was doing, and then they could come back down and give a report. Now, can you imagine if someone's in the trenches, here's a guy coming down from a balloon, the guy in the balloon says, hey, look, they're bringing in reinforcements here and here and here. You need to strengthen yourself here. And the guy goes, who are you? You got your little hot air balloon? Who cares? We're the ones down here in the trenches fighting. This is what we see. You would look at that individual and you would say, no. You're down here. And the hot air balloon's up here. And they got a perspective that you don't have. In humility, listen to this guy. He knows what he's doing, and it's to your advantage to heed him. And this is where the preacher is going with us. Again, remember something. The Bible is not saying that you can never question God, to ask him questions, to tell him about your pain. Not at all. But it is saying you cannot just arrogantly and boldly challenge God.
making demands that he do what you want or answer how you want. Questioning, there's a humility that goes with that. There's an understanding of who God is, expressing your pain, but faith and trust ultimately, even with what you don't understand. But challenging, that's a whole different animal. Don't forget. Now you're basically saying, God, you have to answer me with an answer that I find satisfactory. So you come to my level and you make this happen in accordance to my terms. And the undertone when we come in that way and in that manner is one of unbelief. We don't trust the one who could see all things. We're trusting what we can see and what we can assess. And verse 3 kind of gives us a little bit of an illustration by comparison. It says, "For the dream comes through much effort, and the voice of a fool through many words." So this is a little bit of a comparison. You know, you look at that and think, what in the world is that about? He's saying, you know, when you work hard and you put a lot of effort into something, it makes you tired. And, you know, at night you sleep pretty good. Some of you may have gone out and played some sports yesterday, or you mowed your yard, you did a lot of physical activity, and more than likely when you went to bed, you slept pretty sound. And if there's a lot on your mind, sometimes you'll even dream about the work, right? Well, he's saying, just like hard work is going to put you into a good sleep at night, he says a fool is going to produce a lot of these empty words. They're just going to be talking and demanding, but they're not going to consider who it is that they're addressing. So let me shift gears on you here. Is there any application for a New Testament Christian in this today? Yes, there is. I told you about upside down flying and how uncomfortable it is. We're going to get a little uncomfortable, all right? But realize something, so is everybody else. You're not the only one. How'd you come to worship today? When you came in, did you prepare your heart? When you were singing the songs, did you purpose to think, what is it that I'm proclaiming? What is it that we're singing here? What are we declaring unto God? When we prayed, when you took communion, was God the object of your worship? Or were you in the Bahamas for a few minutes, thinking about the vacation maybe that you'd like, or maybe something that's coming up, or the task that you've got going on this afternoon, or the things you didn't get done yesterday? How did you approach God, and did you give it any thought? Some of you, when you worship, you raise your hands. Others of you, you keep them by your side. That doesn't matter. What did you do here? What did you do here? Where were you with Him? We just had offertory, and you're giving. Is that an act of worship? Or for those of you that are giving, is it kind of mindless? And, you know, you don't even really give it a second thought. I personally don't give, in our giving, we don't give in the offering plate. We've gone online and we've made it automated. And one of the things that I love is every week I get a little receipt, if you will, through email saying, this money has been taken out of your account. I've had the purpose to stop and say, okay, wait a minute, this is part of my act of worship. Because I don't want my giving to go on autopilot. I want to stop and I want to think, okay, no, wait. I'm able to give because God has given to me. And this is part of my sacrifice that I can give back unto Him. But how deliberate are we when we approach Him, when we worship Him, when we pray to Him? When you're praying, what's going on? Are you just rambling a bunch of words, kind of filling in the time? Or do you realize and recognize who it is that we come before to worship? God would have us come to Him and not be pretentious with Him. What do I mean when I say pretentious? I actually went to Webster's and put this together here. Pretentious means an inadequate or insincere attempt to attain a certain condition or quality. And sometimes we can do that in how we approach God, can't we? You know, give me what I want, do what I want. I'll do this just as long as you'll get this done. Or maybe we go, you know, on Sunday morning because we're supposed to do it. And all of a sudden, all this stuff is, you know, the real act of worship maybe has gone or has left. It makes me think of the story of the two prayers in the New Testament that Jesus tells us about. One, you got this Pharisee who comes in and says, Lord, I thank you. I'm not like all these, you know, like all y'all. You know, I'm doing all this. I do these things. But the object of his worship was himself. Contrasted with the tax collector who came in and said, "Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner." And he realized, I've come into the presence of a holy and righteous God. And there's a sobriety that he had when he entered into the presence of God. Are you uncomfortable yet? Yeah? Okay, good. Because this was convicting to me. You know, I have sung songs before and realized after the fact, wait, what did we just sing? What was I doing in those last few moments? And this is a good challenge for us. How do we approach God? And the preacher's going to go one step further here on us in considering how we might treat God in a trite way. Look at verse 4. When you make a vow to God, do not be late in paying it. For he takes no delight in fools. Pay what you vow. Now let's realize something. In the Old Testament, a lot of times people made vows to God for a variety of things. And when you made these vows, it was a voluntary thing. This was not something God necessarily required of you. You chose to do it. And usually it was in response to something. It was a way that you could show a different level of devotion or thanksgiving unto God. But here the preacher is saying, look, you need to be careful when you do that kind of thing. Don't be rash in your vows. Because if you're going to proclaim a sacrifice and an action, then you need to take that seriously. You need to do it. And what another thing this reminds me of, New Testament, book of Acts, chapter 5. Man and a woman, Ananias and Sapphira. They sell a piece of their property. They take some of the proceeds of that sale and they bring it to the house of God and they offer it unto him, you know, as an act of devotion. And God took both their lives. Oh, wait a minute. They gave something. Why would God take their life? Well, he took it because they lied. They brought part of the proceeds, but they told them, and they in essence were telling God, this is all of the proceeds. And at its heart, we know what they were doing. They were putting on a show so that others would see them and think they're holy. This was not an outward worship. This was not a recognition of who God is. It's just sort of this thing about how can I get the attention onto myself. It was a self-worship. And it all came about just as they're being sort of this, we got this great idea, and they're just acting rashly. They're not really stopping to think about it, and it's disrespectful to God. In verse 5, it says, it's better that you should not vow than that you should vow and not pay. Don't trifle with God. That's what it's saying. And if Ananias could somehow reappear and sit in one of these pews today and be listening to this, I guarantee you something. You'd be hearing somebody over, you know, in this section where he is going, preach it, brother. Amen. All right. I know what you're talking about. And the scripture gives us that example so that we can learn from it. Verse 6, don't let your speech cause you to sin, and do not say in the presence of the messenger of God that it was a mistake. Why should God be angry on account of your voice and destroy the work of your hands? So again, let's step back in Old Testament times and let's imagine you're a Jew. And you make a vow to God and you say, God, you've just done so much. I want to show you my devotion. Here's what I'm going to do. 20% of everything I own, I'm giving to you. I got 10 cows, you're getting two of them. I got 10 sheep, you're getting two of them. And he's making this commitment. And then something happens, breaks his leg, can't tend the farm. And all of a sudden he says, oh, God, you know, I made you that vow. But here's the deal. The situation has changed. So I'm not going to go through with it. And by not fulfilling that vow, while it sounds very practical, let's look at what this individual's actions would be screaming. God, you aren't trustworthy. I made a commitment. You threw me a curveball. I don't trust you anymore. And I'm not going to go through with what I said. And verse 7 gives us another illustration of this. It says, for in many dreams and in many words there is emptiness, rather fear God. Y'all ever had one of those dreams that when you're going through it, it just felt so real? When you woke up, you just weren't even sure what to do with it? My sister and her husband tell a story. It's kind of funny, but maybe not. Where she had a dream that he was seeing another woman. And it was so real. When she woke up, she was so mad at him. And so all morning long, she's mad and everything, even though she told him it was a dream. And finally, he said, had to say, stop it. That was not real. That was your dream. And while it might have felt real to you, I am not doing anything like that. And yet, somehow in her mind, it felt like it was very real. And here's what the preacher is telling us. He says, look, don't let your promises and your words be like something that was a dream. Boy, it felt real. But at the end of the day, there really is nothing here to go with it. It doesn't align with reality. Now, this is one of those passages we can read and we listen. We say, well, that's great. That sounds like an Old Testament thing. You know, that doesn't really apply to us today because we don't offer these vows and things like that today. Unless maybe, I don't know, maybe some of you did, you know, when you took that test that you didn't study for, said, Lord, please let me get an A. And if you do, I promise, I vow that I will study for the next one. I'm not talking about that at all. You know, what kind of vows do we give? At the end of the day, there really, in our day, there really is, I think, pretty much only one vow that we typically give. And that's the one that we'll make to a spouse before God. Right? You go to a wedding. I just went to one last night. It was great. And as I'm watching everything unfold and as I'm seeing these vows, it's just this commitment that each couple is making to one another. But at the same time, they're also making it before God and to a degree with God. And how does the vow go? It says this, I'm going to love this person standing here before me. I'm going to love them with the same kind of love that God has for me. We'll look at the man and the husband say, wife, I'm going to love you like Jesus Christ loves his church. I'm going to love you sacrificially. I'm going to love you unconditionally. Can I talk about this a minute? Yeah? Let me talk to you guys first. Guys, I have no doubt, 90% of you, 99% of you, if push came to shove, you would take a bullet for your wife, wouldn't you? You got in that kind of a situation, she's going to get killed. You will jump in front of that bullet and you will save her life. But let's also be very honest. Probably ain't none of us going to have to show that kind of level of commitment, are we? How are we going to show it? Here's how you're going to show it. You're coming home from work. You're just ready to get home. She calls and says, hey, can you stop and just get an extra gallon of milk? Ugh. You know, just extending my day that much further. And yet, no, this is an opportunity for you to actually show love in a very tangible way and deny yourself. Maybe instead of something like this, take her out for coffee. Take her out on a date, not on a holiday. Not on one of those days, you know, where you're already obligated, you feel like, to give flowers or something like that. No. You just call her up, surprise her. Or even better, make the appointment. And you take care of the babysitting, if that's necessary. You get all that set up. Man, what are you going to communicate to her? This is what this kind of a vow looks like. It's saying, I know what I have committed unto God, and I'm going to reveal kind of what I think about God by how I treat this other person. Guys, let me tell you how you can know that you've hit the big leagues on this. When you're coming home and your wife says, hey, I need you to stop and get some feminine products. Would you do that? And you go, you bet, sweetheart, I got you covered. And now that is a guy who's willing to sacrifice. Let me tell you. Let me not just stop there with the guys, though. Let me go on to you wives. Wives, do you love him like the church is meant to love Christ? That's part of your vow. See, remember, the vow is not merely, we're going to stay married till one of us dies, because more often than not, that's just going to prompt you to kill one another so you can end that vow a little bit sooner. The vow is much deeper than that. It isn't just stay married. It's not. The vow is to love that person and to give and to sacrifice for them. And wives, how are you responding? You know, one of the things that can typically happen, let's just be real candid, ladies, as we get a little bit older, guy comes up behind you, puts his arms around you, kisses you on the neck, And what do you do?
What are you doing? Cut that out. Stop. Back up. Get away from me. And kind of get a little bit fussy, right? And say, this is inconveniencing me because I got my plan of what it is that I want to do. And you're kind of getting in the way of my plan. Let me just tell you this. No man wants to be an activity on your to-do list. He doesn't want to, doesn't want that kind of a response. You know what he wants? He wants to be that interruption that you're hoping will come your way. That you can be with him. That you can do something with him. That you, that he knows you love him more than you love the kids. That's part of the vow. That's what it's meant to look like. And when we do this kind of a vow and we live it in this kind of a way, is that not a blessing? It is a blessing to one another. It is a blessing to any children if God gives them to you. My goodness, are they blessed when they see how you love one another. It is a blessing to your neighbors, to your community, when they see you living this kind of a vow before God to one another. It is phenomenal. And at the same time, I can agree with what this text says. If we don't do this, it is sin. And sin always will burn you. It brings heartache. It brings pain. It will to you. It will to your spouse. It will to your children. It will to the people around you. It will to your church. You know that? The call is to love. And that's what you vow. By the strength and the power of God, you'll do it. This, incidentally, is why I will not do a wedding unless I get to do, or somebody in this church gets to do, premarital counseling with a couple. I will not do that wedding. Single people, just know that up front. Nothing personal. But if you can't go through the premarital counseling, we're not going to do this with you. And here's why. I don't want you making this kind of a rash vow like we see in Ecclesiastes. The purpose is that you come soberly. This comes well thought out. This isn't some impulsive thing. When you come here to get premarital counseling, you know what you're getting? 10 meetings minimum, about an hour and a half to 2 hours each, and homework in between each meeting. And we're going to have you talk and think and pray and really consider a lot of different things. We're going to talk about things like communicating with one another and your finances. We're going to talk about things like communicating with one another and intimacy. We're going to talk about things like communicating with one another and suffering together and communicating with one another and the biblical roles we have. You see a common theme here. It's a big deal. And this is all part of this whole vow aspect, that you can bless others, be blessed, and bless God. And the reason we do it is not merely to make it hard. We don't want you to dishonor God and then come away later and go, you know, it felt good, but it was a mistake. It was rash and it was impulsive. And that generally is going to happen. You know when that's going to happen, right? The 2-year mark, the 7-year mark, or the 20-year mark? At 2 years, because you finally just said, I can't deal with your selfishness and I'm done with you. But those who can make it past 2, a lot of times what it is like, well, maybe we just need to change the setting here. So let's have a kid. And by having a kid, maybe we'll fix the problem. And that after 5 years of that, you come to the realization, this ain't working, I'm done with you. And then the other stop, maybe if you make it past there, is 20, because then we got the kids out. And then you're eating oatmeal, looking across the table at that person, going, who is that? I don't even think I like them anymore. No. We do not want to see that happen with you. Not at all. Incidentally, shameless plug. If you have a reasonably good marriage, okay, notice I didn't say perfect. If you have a reasonably good marriage and you would like the blessing of taking somebody through something like this, we have materials we can train you with. We got ways that we can put you out there. We won't throw you out there and say swim. We'll give you a young couple, and we'll let you disciple them in and through this and be a huge blessing to help them. You're interested in that? Again, my little commercial. See me after the church, and I will get you fixed up, and I will get you trained. We don't have a whole lot of them, but they keep coming every year.
And they got those big eyes, you know, and they're all googly. And we're not looking to squash that. In fact, we're looking to actually fan those flames even higher, but higher in reality. Realizing this is a commitment before God. And it's a huge blessing. See me afterwards. Can I wrap up here? Next two verses. And let me just tell you right now, you read these and you go, what in the world? How does this fit? He says, if you see oppression of the poor and denial of justice and righteousness in the province, don't be shocked at the sight. For one official watches over another official and there are higher officials over them. After all, a king who cultivates the field is an advantage to the land. If you have notes, you got those little notes in your bulletin, take out your pen and on this section, put a great big asterisk by it. And let me tell you why. Because I'm going to tell you right now my interpretation of this. I've read, I think, 8 different sermon commentaries, input on this, and I've gotten 8 different answers as to people trying to figure out why is this here and what's it saying. So I'm going to give you a suggested interpretation. You need to think about this on your own. I personally think that this relates back to the context of the passage and what we've been looking at. What do we do about those things, like oppression, that challenge our view of God's sovereignty, that make us begin to question Him? And so what do you do? And I think implied here in the preacher's observation is that you would never go boldly to an earthly king who's trying to do good and challenge him about the evil men in his administration and demand that he start making changes and making adjustments because you don't like the way things are working out here. And within here, I think it's the same thing. Just as you would never do that with an earthly king, how much more would we not do it with our heavenly King, who is good and who is working to accomplish His purposes, and He's doing many good things, and yet His plan incorporates sometimes things like oppression and these corrupt people who are doing things that are wrong, and it bothers you and it hurts you. And we can go to Him and we can highlight these things and we can tell Him about these things and we can pray and ask Him to do something about these things, but we cannot go to Him and say, and you will do what I demand of you, or else I don't see you as being worthy. We wouldn't do that. The call in this text, don't be rash and don't be impulsive with God. Emotions, they're good. Untethered emotions, that's not. I started with a flight illustration. Let me end with one. Back in my days when I was in the Navy, was flying from Pensacola to Keesler Air Force Base, doing a little training mission with a student. So we landed there and, you know, ate lunch after we did our first mission. We're getting ready to take off for our second mission, and we're going through the training plan for it. So as we're getting ready, all of a sudden I look out, and there's this big window there in the flight operations, and you can see the flight line, and here comes a civilian plane. This is an Air Force base. A civilian plane taxiing up and pulling up over here. And as I'm looking at that, I thought, what's going on there? And then I knew when I saw 3 men with M16 rifles walk out to the flight line and surround that plane. And the plane shuts down, and a man gets out, and another man gets out, and then a semi-hysterical woman crying gets out, and another semi-hysterical woman crying gets out. And I knew what had happened. Let me explain what occurred. Keesler Air Force Base is right next to Biloxi Civilian Airport, and the runways look exactly the same. So this guy is flying into the airport. They're coming. You know, this is a time when all the casinos are there, probably going to go gambling. And they just got confused on which airport it was that they were going into. Now, there's a very simple way to avoid this, and that is, as you were getting ready to go into your airport, you dialed in the navigational aids, you listened to it. A little Morse code would come up telling you that you're at the right airport, so you'd double-check that. And then you'd look at your navigational aids, and if they lined up, you knew that's the right runway. What did this guy do? He was rash. He was impulsive. I know what the runway looks like. I've been there before. I got this covered. He didn't do any of that, and he just went on in there and wound up landing at the wrong place. And I remember hearing him as I'm watching him fill out this form where he's probably going to get fined or something's going to happen to his license or whatever. He's going, I never made a mistake like this before. And I remember thinking, and you probably never will make this mistake ever again. And I bring that up because it comes back and it relates directly to the passage here. How are you going to approach God? Do we treat him common? Just impulsive? Going to say whatever? Challenge him in any way? Or do we come recognizing the holiness, the M16s of his holiness? And know, look, I don't want to go into that. I don't want to face that. I want to go where he wants me to go and be used in the way he wants me to be used, and not in a rash and an impulsive way that brings him dishonor and me pain. Stand with me, would you? Bow your heads as the worship team comes forward. Would you just pray with me? Our Heavenly Father, just thinking about these last few moments, the songs that we sang, the communion that we partook together, and they're great potential acts for where we can worship you. I think about many of the married couples that came in here this morning and how the situation is between them. Father, in all these things, we want our vows. We want our devotion to you. We want all of this. Ultimately, we want it to be honoring to you. But all too often, we just let life get in the way. We get a little busy. And we kind of cut you out such that we're only focused on the next thing that we got to do. And maybe we're even a little aggravated with you because you didn't do things the way we wanted you to do them. So, Father, I pray that you take your spirit with this passage and help us to align our hearts with you, to not treat you so rash and so common, but to remember who you are and how much you love us and how heavy of a price you paid to purchase us for your own purposes and to be with you. Lord, let that be what motivates and inspires us, not our list, not our demands. That requires sacrifice. And it requires that I die to myself. By your power and your spirit, Lord, enable us to do that. And we look forward expectantly to the joy that we will have. Even if the world is burning down around us, we'll know we're in your care, we're in your hands. And that's going to be good enough for us. It's in Jesus' name we pray.